Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and we got lots on the agenda today. I'm solo, and I'll be sharing information with you about psychobiotics. What's up with that? We're going to define that term for you, and there's a fascinating new horizon of treating mental and mood problems with probiotics. And also, we'll be talking to you about a remarkable study that suggests that chelation therapy may be particularly helpful for diabetics. These days, we're recommending statin drugs for everyone with diabetes. Well, maybe we should be recommending chelation therapy with the results that we're seeing in a recent study that are just out. And that's a good segue to our initial story, which has to do with statin drugs and new guidelines for prescribing statin drugs. We've talked about this quite a lot in the past couple of weeks. I've wrote an article for Mind Body Green entitled Everything You Need to Know About the New Cholesterol Guidelines. You can check it out, or you can check out some of my recent podcasts on the subject, or you can go to drhoffman.com and read the article that I reposted there with some updates, Everything You Need to Know About the New Cholesterol Guidelines. Basically, to recap, if you haven't heard about this, well, there's new guidelines that suggest that maybe the number of people already on statins, there's 37 million Americans already taking them, should be doubled. We may need to put 70 million or more Americans on statin drugs if these guidelines are to be followed. And I weighed in with my opinion on these guidelines, that the guidelines were imprecise, that there was lots of overkill. And, you know, sometimes I feel like I'm a voice in the wilderness because the mainstream media is often in direct opposition to what I'm saying. But it turns out, and this is the update, mainstream media sources, and it's seldom that I agree with the New York Times, but the New York Times has resoundingly criticized these new guidelines. John Abramson, MD of Harvard Medical School, put out a New York Times op-ed. It's really, really kind of unprecedented that the Times would publish an op-ed that goes against standard medical advice, that actually criticizes the medical establishment. So that's a big deal in and of itself. He wrote an editorial saying, "Don't give more patients statins." And that's pretty interesting because he's not, again, he's not a holistic doctor. He's actually a Harvard based physician and educator. He publishes in major medical journals, and he is of the opinion that statins, while they do provide benefit to people at high risk, for example, today I discussed with a young man. He was just 27, but he's got a very, very strong family history of heart disease. His mother has cholesterol in the 400s. He, on a recent blood test, was found to have a cholesterol of 333 with an HDL of 40. And this is a familial pattern of very, very high cholesterol. Not just, you know, a little bit high, but very high. And I suggested, you know, really, you should go on a statin. He's reluctant to do so at such a young age. I know he doesn't already have heart disease, but with such a high cholesterol, he might be at risk. So, that, you know, certainly there are some people, you know, just for virtually every drug that's around, there are indications for the use of that drug. Many of these drugs, like osteoporosis drugs, for example, are far overused. There are people who really need them, but there's some people who don't need them who get the prescriptions nonetheless. So in the past couple of weeks, it's gotten worse. You know, the healthcare.gov website is not the only website that is having some problems. There's a website that was put out by the American Heart Association and the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, which is a website that's supposed to calculate your risk for the need to go on cholesterol-lowering medications. And, you know, it's interesting. It's got, you know, you put in your age, you put in your sex, you put in your height and weight, you put in your waist circumference, and you put in various statistics about your cholesterol and the HDL and so on and so on, and it spits out a result that's supposed to tell you whether you're at high risk or low risk of cardiovascular disease. I took the test, and incidentally, and despite the fact that I'm in pretty darn good shape, I barely passed. I was placed at 6.5% risk of cardiovascular problems within the next 10 years. If I had been more than 7.5%, I would have been, it would have been suggested automatically that I go on statin drugs. Well, some people, have played around with this, and they pointed out that one of the fascinating things about this website is that if you are a black male of middle age, this is funny, folks, you're virtually certain to be told that you need to go on a statin drug, even if you're in excellent health. I mean, you could be a 55-year-old track star, pole vaulter, triathlete, you know, in stuntman in Hollywood with fabulous cholesterol, great blood pressure, everything's good. But because you're black, because you're African-American, the assumption is that you might have higher risk. So, in effect, we are racially profiling an entire population segment in America, causing them to appear to need statin drugs without any discretion whatsoever. So that is truly absurd. I got an interesting Facebook post. By the way, I invite you to friend me or follow me on Facebook because interesting stuff gets posted there. One of my astute Facebook friends said that he had taken the self-test via the calculator at www.heart.org. And I suggest that you go there and check it out. It's interesting. And, you know, take the test, plug in the numbers, see if they make sense for you. My Facebook friend, by the way, he is a healthy 60-something baby boomer, but he's very athletic and keeps himself in impeccably good condition. He says, I looked at the calculator and what stood out like a sore thumb is there is no question for whether the participant is taking a statin drug. Now, that's actually a very good point. He goes on to say, and I'll explain what I mean in a second. My wife's cholesterol issue is genetic and her total went from 280 to 160 with the drug. The calculator now puts her at a 1% risk, where I am at an 8% risk. That means he's greater than 7.5, so he needs to go on a statin drug with a total cholesterol of 200 and a blood pressure of 105. Does this thing seem rigged? He asks. And the answer is yes. And he actually points out something quite fascinating is let's say you had a very high cholesterol. And now just by virtue of going on a statin drug, your cholesterol was dramatically reduced. Cholesterol, you know, statin drugs do work to lower cholesterol. So before you went on the statin drug, you might have, let's just say for the sake of the argument, a 12% risk of having a heart attack within the next 10 years. And by virtue of going on a cholesterol-lowering medication, your cholesterol could go down 100 points, right? So in this case, that's precisely what happened. It went down to 120 points. It went from 280 to 160 with the drug that his wife was taking. So when you plug her new numbers in the calculator, perhaps in the past, I'm just estimating that her risk was 12%. Her risk goes to just 1% with the drug. Well, there's no question on the calculator saying, how did you get to 160? If you were 160 to begin with, that's a heck of a lot better than if you artificially lower it with a drug. In fact, this glitch in the programming of www.heart.org, you know, glitches in both healthcare.gov and in www.heart.org. This glitch in the programming, call it a glitch, or maybe just something that is an unanticipated consequence of, you know, garbage in, garbage out. Because of this glitch, it suggests that this cholesterol-lowering drug dramatically reduced this woman's risk of cardiovascular disease, but from taking it from relatively high to virtually nil, when we know very well that statin drugs don't do that. They can lower risk slightly, but not so dramatically. So that is a good point in and of itself. And They were actually in the past week, and this is just unprecedented. The New York Times took the step of issuing an editorial entitled Cholesterol Guidelines Under Attack. And I'll share with you some of what they wrote. And this is pretty strong stuff coming from a mainstream publication like the New York Times. They say it pretty clearly. Patients in good cardiovascular health would be well advised to stay away for now from following the cholesterol guidelines issued last week by the nation's two leading heart organizations. Wow. Well, you're saying, well, oh, but if I have high cholesterol, I'm not in good cardiovascular health. Well, the definition of bad cardiovascular health means that you have been demonstrated to have heart disease by virtue of an abnormal stress test, or perhaps an abnormal angiogram, or perhaps you've had a stent or bypass surgery, or maybe you've even had a heart attack. That means you have cardiovascular disease. Having high cholesterol when you're healthy and you don't have any major risk factors for cardiovascular disease, you just have high cholesterol, means that you are in good cardiovascular health. So what they're saying is, that's pretty stark. They're saying, ignore the new guidelines. They continue. The guidelines are accompanied by an online calculator that appears to overestimate greatly. New York Times says this, not me. The calculator appears to overestimate greatly the risk of heart attack or stroke that currently healthy individuals might face over the next decade. As a result, tens of millions of people could be prescribed cholesterol-lowering statin drugs that they don't really need. And what they say here is that if the risk is C7.5%, the patient's supposed to take statins. Under that calculation, some 33 million people between the ages of 40 and 79 exceed that threshold and are eligible for treatment with statin drugs. They point out that a commentary that has recently been published in The Lancet by Dr. John Abramson, who we're trying like heck to get as a guest here on the Intelligent Medicine Podcast, but I guess he's busy because he's been really in demand and he's doing a lot of speaking and he's doing a lot of interviewing for major newspapers. In this leading medical journal, The Lancet, John Abramson and his associates estimate that as many as half of the 33 million do not actually have risk thresholds that exceed 7.5%, and that even patients with healthy characteristics would be deemed candidates for statins. Other experts who have tested the calculator found absurd results. Pretty absurd results. You know, every black person under the age of 55 needs to be on a statin drug? I don't think so. They say, and this is the New York Times again, statins are among the safest prescription drugs available. Well, I could quarrel with that, but let's even accept that premise. But they go on to say, but they do have adverse side effects in some patients, including muscle pain and muscle damage and increased risk of diabetes, especially in women, memory loss and confusion, cataracts, and sometimes kidney or liver damage. So I don't think I could have said it any better. That's the New York Times. And then, okay, let's go to Canada. What's the biggest and most popular and influential newspaper in Canada? Well, it's called the Toronto Globe and Mail. It's kind of like the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal of Canada. And they published an editorial saying, quote, it's time to question the new guidelines on cholesterol drugs. So here you have some of what they have to say, very similar to the themes that were enumerated in the New York Times editorial. They say it's time to question the new guidelines on cholesterol drugs. According to the new guidelines published by the American Heart Association, the American College of Cardiology, every Caucasian male over the age of 62, every African-American man over 65, every white female over 70, and every black female over 69 should be taking statin medications, not to mention a whole bunch of younger people. I don't know if that may be a little bit of a rhetorical exaggeration, but they're saying a heck of a lot of innocent people are going to be pulled into this dragnet. What they say, again, this is dramatic stuff for a major newspaper and for newspapers to go up against major cardiology organizations. It's great, finally, that journalists are talking back to the medical establishment. So often they just pass along uncritically the recommendations of medical gurus. And here's what they say. The arbitrary cholesterol targets are not supported by scientific evidence. Let's not forget that about 3/4 of people have normal cholesterol levels when they have heart attacks. That hasn't changed during the great statins experiment of the past decade. So here's the final take home from the Toronto Globe and Mail. And brace yourself, because this is a blockbuster. Here's what they have to say. Quote, statins are not magical medications for prevention of heart disease. They give the illusion of protection. It is a costly illusion that needs to be shattered. So they're pretty resounding opinions from some of the mainstream media, often foes of the kinds of ideas we want to put across here on the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. But you get the idea. Okay, this next story fits in nicely with what we just discussed, because a while back we talked about something called the TACT trial. It was a study of chelation therapy that was undertaken several years ago and finally was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. But unlike statins, chelation therapy, which is an intravenous treatment that I've been administering to patients for, perhaps 2 decades, and is a therapy advocated by many complementary physicians for preventing and reversing cardiovascular disease, well, in the words of Rodney Dangerfield, it just don't get no respect. And even when the results of the TACT trial were published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, they were greeted with derision or with yawns by the medical profession. This is the very selfsame medical profession that is enamored of the use of statin drugs and other types of drug therapy for cardiovascular prevention, of course, bypass surgery and stent therapy. These are among the favorite ways we have of dealing with cardiovascular disease, but not chelation. All right, so what they did with this chelation study, that's old news. It came out a year ago. We thoroughly discussed it. But sometimes when you do studies, they take the data from the studies and they subject it to rigorous statistical analysis. And sometimes this takes years. For example, with the Women's Health Initiative study, a study that, early in the 2000s showed that heart disease risk was increased with hormone replacement therapy. Many women went off hormone replacement therapy undergoing hot flashes and hormone withdrawal because they felt they were going to get heart attacks. Well, years later, they took the very same data. The data hadn't changed. They just looked at it in a different way. And they said, well, you know, really wasn't the case that it caused heart attacks. It only caused heart attacks in the older women who already had heart disease who were taking it. Their average age was 66. But when you gave it to younger women, it was actually protective against cardiovascular disease. Well, they looked at the TACT study and what they found. And by the way, this is published in Forbes magazine, a major business magazine. So this article that I'm sharing with you was front and center in the media, and I posted it rather gleefully on Facebook, if you follow me there. What they're saying here, they repeat the previous results. They found that there was a significant reduction in the risk of death from heart attack, stroke, or also the incidence of heart attacks and strokes, the need for having a bypass surgery or a stent, or being hospitalized for angina. It was lowered from 30% of the placebo group to 26% in the chelation group. Okay, that's not much, but that's a significant difference. There was also after 5 years of follow-up, there was a 15% difference between the groups. There was a highly significant 41% reduction in the chelation group. And now what they find is, upon reanalyzing the data, that there was an even more dramatic reduction in the risk of heart problems in diabetics. Now, diabetics are a group that is specifically targeted for cardiovascular prevention. In fact, under the new guidelines for statin prescribing, they're saying all diabetics between the age of 40 and 79 whether it's type 2 or type 1, they all need to be on statin drugs because they're at high risk for heart disease. What they found in this study was that there was a highly significant reduction in risk in patients with diabetes. So the result was a 41% decrease in the risk of death, heart attack, stroke, the need for bypass or stent or subsequent hospitalization for angina. And 41%, I mean, that is a spectacular result. If it were a drug, the drug would immediately be fast-tracked. The FDA would seek its rapid approval. It would be advertised widely because, you know, how can you beat a drug that reduces the risk of heart attack and diabetes or stroke or death or the need for bypass or, you know, getting in trouble going to the hospital with a heart problem by 41%. That's pretty darn good. Well, that's what chelation did in the subsequent reanalysis. And that's pretty darn good. The second study, which has just been presented, you know, shows that there was a benefit to chelation therapy, a dramatic benefit. And the authors write that we need to do more studies. The findings, quote, support the initiation of clinical trials in patients with diabetes and vascular disease to replicate these findings. And when asked what he would tell a patient who asked about chelation, Dr. Tony Lamas, who we've interviewed here on the Intelligent Medicine Podcast, said he would not discourage a post-MI diabetic patient from getting EDTA chelation. He said, quote, he or she may be ahead of the curve. And I'm proud to say that we here on Intelligent Medicine have been ahead of the curve in not just approving chelation therapy or condoning it, but recommending it and, in fact, administering to chelation to scores of patients, especially diabetic patients who are at high risk over these many years. Clearly, there are signs that it could be enormously beneficial. And this new study really underscores that benefit. Okay, I have this new thing that I'm sort of fooling around with, which is the, quote, word of the day. I posted on Twitter. My Twitter handle, if you want to follow me on Twitter, is at Dr. Ronald Hoffman. And I posted on Facebook. Many more of you are on Facebook than on Twitter. Twitter is kind of a new thing, although it just went public with an IPO. But there's a lot of information to be found via social media. And the word of the day that I put up just today was psychobiotics. Psychobiotics. And I found that a fascinating word of the day because what in the heck does this new word mean? It's a brand new word. And it's a term that has been coined to suggest that probiotics can actually promote changes in mood and mental health. All right, we now know that there is a linkage between the gut and the brain, and it's a profound one. There's actually more nerves in your gastrointestinal tract than there are in your brain. So if you, you know, you wonder, you know, which end of you is controlling you, it might actually be your gastrointestinal tract. Also, there's implications for your immune system, for inflammation, you name it. And we're coming to appreciate more the role of what's called the microbiome. These are the bacteria and funguses, and I suppose there's some viruses that inhabit our intestinal tract. And there are far more of them than there are of us by a factor of perhaps 10 or 100. We have trillions of cells in our body. We have many more cells, bacterial cells in our gastrointestinal tracts. And it turns out that the composition of our flora, the healthy bacteria or not so healthy bacteria that populate our intestinal tract can govern our moods. This study published in the journal Biological Psychiatry introduces the term psychobiotic as, quote, a live organism that, when ingested in adequate amounts, produces a health benefit in patients suffering from psychiatric illness. Wow, that is so cool. First question that somebody posted on my Facebook page was, what probiotic shall I take to enhance my mood? And the answer is not so clear yet. And it may also be different strokes for different folks, just as some patients respond to certain natural things like St. John's wort or SAMe. Others don't respond. And similarly with drugs. There's some people who do great with certain drugs, don't respond at all with certain drugs. Some people who are supposed to respond well to certain drugs feel terrible on certain drugs. So there's a lot of uncertainties when it comes to mental health. It turns out that bacteria produce neurotransmitters. All right. Either they directly make it or they influence the body to produce more. So neurotransmitters are the things that affect our thoughts and moods. And that's actually how drugs work, by influencing the levels of neurotransmitters. If you say, these days it's kind of fashionable to say, I'm on antidepressants because I went to the doctor and the doctor said I had a chemical imbalance. So in order to fix thy chemical imbalance, he's giving me a medication that modifies the chemicals in my brain, and therefore I feel better, less anxious, more positive, less despondent. But norepinephrine is one of the more important ones, and it is thought to be something that has a stimulating effect. It's part of the catecholamine family. It turns out that E. coli, there are actually good and bad E. coli, Bacillus species and Saccharomyces, you've heard of Florastor or Saccharomyces boulardii, they produce norepinephrine. Candida, strep, E. coli, and Enterococcus produce serotonin, and Bacillus and Serratia have the potential to produce dopamine. Now, these bacteria, they're not all good. It's not necessarily great to have candida in your intestinal tract. That can actually cause you to feel kind of poorly. But we know that they do have an influential effect on our thoughts and moods. So what they say here in this article is if we find significant changes in the microbiota, that's the bacteria that inhabit our intestine, in conditions such as depression or schizophrenia, then normalizing the microbiota with psychobiotics may alleviate the symptoms. You can tell that this is just in its infancy because they know that there's a connection. They just don't know how to manipulate it. They say that they need more studies, and they are underway, or they're soon to be underway. Placebo-controlled studies are up and coming in the U.S. and Europe. And if all goes well, get ready for this, folks. This is what you're looking for. Quote, a product should be available within 5 years for the treatment of stress-related disorders such as anxiety, depression, and irritable bowel syndrome. That's pretty cool, right? Why do they say irritable bowel syndrome? Well, actually, neurotransmitters play a role in the speed up or slow down of your intestinal tract. So if you're constipated, maybe you're not making enough neurotransmitters to get the nerves working in your intestinal tract. If you're having chronic diarrhea and urgency, it may be that you're overproducing certain neurotransmitters, or you don't have enough inhibitory neurotransmitters to slow down your intestinal transit. All this stuff is amazing and fascinating because we know that I talked to a patient today who we were suffering both anxiety and chronic urgency. We gave her a low-dose antidepressant medication, and anxiety has improved. And, oh, by the way, no more diarrhea. So clearly, neurotransmitters may play a role, not just in the function of the intestine, but in the function of the brain. And if we can avoid using drugs and use psychobiotics instead, how cool would that be? And finally, I thought I'd pass this along to you because it's an interesting potential treatment for the many of you out there who suffer from tendonitis. Conditions that are related to tendonitis are tennis elbow and plantar fasciitis, which is a painful condition of the feet. And the way I came across this is very interesting. I was working out in the gym, and I started talking to a guy who then I mentioned that I was a doctor, and he says, I got to tell you about this. He was a young, healthy-looking 40-something guy who said that he had had terrible tendonitis of the elbow, sometimes referred to as tennis elbow or golfer's elbow. And he said that he was in such excruciating pain. He said on a scale of 0 to 10, 10 being the worst, his pain was a 12. And he could virtually pick up nothing. This is a guy who regularly lifts weight. Maybe he overdid it. But, you know, a lot of people develop this just from carrying a briefcase or playing tennis or golfing. It's a very debilitating condition, and normally it's treated with steroid injections, which often, they wear out. And actually, a recent study showed that steroid injections don't do much for tennis elbow. Maybe temporary relief, but long term, they do nothing. So he said, "Doc, I got to tell you about this," because he said, "I am the first patient in New York City to have undergone an innovative new treatment for tennis elbow. And I got to tell you, it's a remarkable treatment." He said, and this I'm quoting, so this may sound blasphemous, but he said, "You know, I don't believe in God, but I believe in this." It's a blasphemous statement, but this guy was so ecstatic about the pain relief that he got. And he said it was a pioneering treatment that has just been introduced. It's FDA approved, but he was the first patient in New York to undergo the treatment at NYU, the New York University Hospital. Also known as Langone Medical Center. And he said when it was being done, the doctors were so new to this that the room was crowded with doctors who wanted to observe. What it entails, but I'll give you the name, and there's a website. It's called the 10X Health Treatment, or the 10X Treatment. The website is 10X Health, T-E-N-E-X, health.com. It's a minimally invasive treatment, but there is a tiny insertion that needs to be made near the tendon. What then happens is a tiny probe is inserted lengthwise within the tendon. So if the probe goes in the tendon, and then there's a treatment that is apparently some form of vibrational treatment, ultrasound, and it sort of vibrates away the scar tissue. It's a cutting treatment, but actually not a scalpel treatment. It vibrates away somehow the treatment, and it's done under ultrasound visualization so they can see precisely what they're doing so they don't do too much, too little. The treatment time is about 20 minutes. It's performed with a local anesthetic. There's a recovery time of a few weeks while you take it easy and it heals. But at the end of the treatment, if it's performed as successfully as it was for this individual, people can obtain significant relief from tendonitis. The formal term for this is percutaneous tenotomy. It's spelled T-E-N-O-T-O-M-Y, and percutaneous fasciotomy, but it's abbreviated 10X. And I share it with you as a heads up on a potential treatment. I don't think it's being offered that extensively, but I'm sure it's going to take the sports medicine world by storm. Ask your orthopedist or sports medicine therapist about the availability of – or podiatrist. Certainly podiatrists will be offering this if this is going to be helpful for plantar fasciitis, which is a very stubborn, painful condition of the feet. And I think it's going to really take off. 10xhealth.com. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Thanks very much for joining us. And don't forget to check out our website, drhoffman.com. Follow me on Twitter at drronaldhoffman. And friend me on Facebook. And if you want, sign up for a newsletter. radioprogram@aol.com is the way to sign up for a newsletter. And stay tuned because we're going to have some exciting news for you in the next couple of weeks or so about Health Talk, our weekly radio program on WOR Radio. We'll keep you in suspense for just a little while longer, but an announcement soon to follow. You've just listened to a free podcast brought to you by yours truly and the Hoffman Center. F-R-E-E is my favorite four-letter word, but these podcasts do involve time and money to produce. And so in the spirit of defraying some of our very real production costs and to keep these podcasts flowing, I'd like to ask you to consider a couple of things. First, if you like what you're hearing, please share these podcasts with your friends and relatives. Our object is to continue the spectacular growth of the Intelligent Medicine Podcast with the goal of attaining 250,000 podcast downloads per month in 2014. I know that with the help of dedicated listeners like you, it'll happen. Second, Go to drhoffman.com and click on the store and consider buying your supplements via our convenient internet portal. Or call the Hoffman Center and talk to one of our friendly supplement advisors. We only stock the very highest quality supplements, some of which are very hard to find elsewhere. The very same supplements that I talk about here on Intelligent Medicine and that I prescribe to my patients at the Hoffman Center. And finally, consider becoming a patient at the Hoffman Center. I can personally perform an extensive workup on you, applying all the Intelligent Medicine principles that you hear about on these podcasts, or alternatively, make an appointment with Layla Mutin, our Hoffman Center nutritionist. You already know her as a frequent contributor on Intelligent Medicine, and she'll provide you with expert advice on diet and supplements. Anyway, thanks for listening, and continue enjoying our Intelligent Medicine podcasts.